Hello and welcome to episode 84 of the Thinking Poker Podcast. You probably know the drill by now. This is a rebroadcast of episode 84, which originally aired way back in 2014. There was a brief period of time when the Thinking Poker Podcast was on a poker news podcast feed. And so those of you who subscribed to the Thinking Poker feed and have maybe gone back, you know, who've started listening to us in the last 5 years, have gone back through the archives to hear more of our shows, that's awesome. and we're glad that you're doing that. There were some episodes that you would not have found in the feed, thanks to Russ Fox. We have access to those now, and we have the rights to use them. I just didn't have the files. Thankfully, Russ has been a longtime listener and did have the files and was able to share those with me. So I've been re-uploading those from time to time. So this is a 2014 interview with Alex Fitzgerald. Very enjoyable, in my opinion, but you'll hear us talk a little bit more about it. On the actual episode. I just do want to remind people, this is a five-year-old episode, so if you hear us talking about things that are upcoming, like a podcast meetup or anything like that, obviously that was upcoming in 2014. It is not upcoming now. I'm going to do my best to scrub the ads from the original, but apologies if one slips through. Obviously, any offers made in those ads are probably not valid now. Speaking of offers, would encourage you to sign up for Tournament Poker Edge. They are our sponsors, have been before 2014, but they were in 2014, and they are now, and they're awesome. And I make videos for them, and you should watch those videos by going to tournamentpokeredge.com. You actually will also find videos there from our guest, Alex Fitzgerald, and from many other former guests on the Thinking Poker Podcast. You can get access to those videos for as little as $25 a month at www.tournamentpokeredge.com. Only other thing I'll ask you to do is if you enjoy this podcast, please rate and review it on iTunes or wherever you found it, really more so even than the sponsorships. We just want more people to hear this show, and your rating and reviewing is the single most useful thing that you can do in that regard. So if you want to help us out, that would be a big help. Thanks a lot. Enjoy the episode.
Danger is stealing in as relapse sums above the den. It's hard to know if this will be the day.
Welcome to episode 83 of the Thinking Poker Podcast.
From the second floor of the Gold Coast Hotel and Casino in Las Vegas, Nevada, I'm Nate Mavis. And with me today is nobody. I am recording the introduction to this episode solo because Andrew is driving across the country, as you've probably read about on his blog. And so it's just me here right now with access to recording equipment and the internet and so on. First, apologies for the audio quality. I'm recording this on an iPad in a hotel room. It is not my usual microphone and internet connection. I hope it's not too bad. And if it is bad, you won't have to put up with it for long. This is going to be a very short introduction. Most of this week's episode will just be our interview, and we hope you enjoy it. We'll be back with a fuller episode next week. But before that, we have just a few reminders for you. First, speaking of the Gold Coast, the Nickcast meetup is here next weekend, Saturday, July 5th at 10 a.m. at the Bowling Alley. Come hang out, maybe have a soda or something, and meet a lot of really cool people. Last year, it was really fun. I'm looking forward to it. Andrew's looking forward to it. A lot of other people are looking forward to it. And we hope you come out and say hello. Second, although there's not going to be as much strategy content in this episode as there usually is, we would like to remind you that the strategy content in the Thinking Poker Podcast is often brought to you by Tournament Poker Edge. You know, one thing that I've noticed that's really striking to me as I'm out here this year and every year is that the gap between not only the best players and the worst players, but also the players who are really working at it in a disciplined way, and the players who just kind of play a lot and try to think about it a little bit, even that latter gap is growing. There's a bigger and bigger difference between the people who are really studying the game, really working at it, and the ones who are just kind of moving along, trying to passively learn from their experience. So the gap between the people who are working really hard and the people who are just trying to passively learn is getting larger and larger. A lot of people in Thinking Poker Nation choose to do their active work and to be on the right side of that gap with Tournament Poker Edge. Andrew makes great videos, a lot of other people make great videos, and a lot of people use the forums as a place to really examine their beliefs and really work hard at improving their play. And with that, I have a very short meditation. It's not really a whole strategy segment, it's just a very small note. I was playing Super Razdoogie yesterday, and if you don't know how Super Razdoogie is played, you're far from alone, but glossing over details, it's a split pot game, it's a stud game, half the pot goes to the best Raz hand, half the pot goes to the best Badoogie. I had been driving the action with an ace, I had something like ace 6, 9, 10 or something like that. I had a 9 low and a 9 Badoogie. I was against two opponents. One had been calling the whole way and was showing something like 4 of spades, jack of spades, 10 of spades, 7 of diamonds, something like that. And the other one had defended a queen and had some medium cards. And from the action, it was pretty clear that the second opponent had a reasonable draw both ways, something like a draw to an 8 Badoogie and a draw to an 8 low. Now, it's also pretty clear that the first opponent has to have, let's pick up the action on 6th Street. The first opponent bets. And with 3 spades and 1 low diamond on board, especially if the first opponent actually can stand all the action, I mean, never mind that the calls on 3rd, 4th, and 5th Street may have been poor, but at the point where her board is 4 of spades, jack of spades, 10 of spades, 7 of diamonds, and then she comes out betting on 6th Street, which she did, she has to have a Badoogie. There's really no other way. Why else? What could she have been calling with other than a draw to a Badoogie and 3 low cards and to come out betting into a very scary board? I've been playing very aggressively. She really has to have made it. And then the player in between called, and I decided to raise for a few reasons. I thought that first I might have a draw to a better Badoogie. I think I had a draw to a 6 Badoogie. I also had it locked up for low. I had my 9 low, I think, had to be good, at least if the player in the middle wasn't perfect, which it seemed pretty clear from the betting he wasn't. So I thought I was best one way, had a draw the other way, and if I raised, then the worst that could happen was I would get 3 bet by a Badoogie that I was drawing very thin against for that side of the pot, and that might drive out the player in the middle. So I thought that it was one of these places where aggression was called for. So I raised, and I did get 3 bet, but then the player in the middle called, and I called. As it happened, I ended up getting scooped on the end, and I really put in 3 big bets on 6th Street in a very poor spot. And that's, it's unfortunate. You should try not to put in money in split pot games when you're drawing very thin for one half of the pot, unless you're nearly a lock in the other. But a 9 against 2 draws to something that's better than a 9 is far from a lock. But the point is not stud, and the point is not the mechanics of split pot games, which we could talk about for a long time. The point is that I really made a mistake. I made several mistakes, and one of them is that the player in the middle probably was never folding. Once the player in the middle calls the one bet, he probably can't fold even for 2 more, given the situation. His draws, I mean, he can read the board, he can read the hands, he knows that his draws are going to have to be live pretty often. He knows I can't have better than a 9, he knows the other player can't have a good low. It's just not something where he can fold for 2 more bets. And so I made a bit of a hand-reading mistake, really, or like a mistake in figuring out what information was available to the other player. And there's a hold'em lesson here, and there's a general poker lesson here, which is that when you're trying to apply pressure to somebody, you have to make sure that that person hasn't shown so much strength already on that street that it's implausible that the pushing that person around is going to work. You know, once he calls one bet in that spot, even two more bets is not going to push him out. And when I got aggressive, I was insufficiently attentive to the fact that he'd already shown quite a lot of strength. So, you know, twin lessons here. Lesson number one, are you really going to get this player out of the pot? Lesson number two is sometimes even calling one bet can show a lot of strength. And, you know, we see this sometimes with people who write in, who have a small flush draw and try to run their opponents off the pot and hold them, even though those opponents have shown a lot of strength and are clearly marked with a hand that cannot fold. So that's the short meditation today. It's aggressive play is great, but don't risk getting free-rolled, certainly, when the person you're trying to run out of the pot has already shown a lot of strength. And with that, we will bring you the interview, and we will see you next week, and hopefully sooner than that at the meetup. Take care.
Our guest is Alex Fitzgerald, a professional poker player, professional poker coach, plays online as Assassinato, makes videos for Pocket Five's strategy, right?
Yeah, Pocket Five's training.
Anything I'm leaving off there?
No, I mean, I'm always hawking something, so there's about 30 things I could put in there. But no, yeah, that's the gist of it, and thanks for having me on. It's a pleasure.
Thank you for joining us. So, I mean, you first came up on our show because we had the Saris on here a couple weeks ago, and I know you two are, you haven't done it yet, have you, your rap battle?
No, we haven't yet.
Probably it will be done by the time this airs, but I think it'll still be interesting for people to hear about this. I mean, what made you want to challenge him to a rap battle in the first place?
A death wish, primarily, but I don't know. The editor at Bluff Magazine mentioned it to me. We like rap battles, and we talk about who we like to watch and all that. And he said, "Hey, would you want to battle the Source?" And you know, he brought this up at last year's World Series. I was like, "Hell no!" You know, I don't want to battle him with like a week notice, right? And then it kind of drifted off or whatever. And then they brought it up again, and I thought, if nobody else wants to do it, I guess the Source has been trying to get this done for a few years. Originally, it was going to do it with Jeff Madsen, but for whatever reason, it didn't work out. And I said, as a joke, I was like, I'll take the bullet. You know, it'd be really funny to hear a poker-themed rap battle, I thought. But the more I've, gotten into it and writing for it, it's been really fun. It's, obviously, there's no guarantee I'll pull it off with any degree of success. Oh, sorry, there's the real world, if you could hear the phone. But, obviously, I've never done this before. Like, I've battle rapped a bit, like, when I was younger, but it was always with, like, six people, and if you could come up with a line that was, like, halfway decent, it was usually way better than the crap people were, quote-unquote, freestyling. The bar was set pretty low. So to go from that to the guy who's, like, arguably the best battle rapper in the world, a lot of guys think that, obviously that's a bit of a switch, but I'm really blessed for the shot. I'm real grateful for the shot, and I thought it'd be fun for the fans. Like, it's not every day you can hear a poker themed rap battle, and there is a ton of stuff to make fun of in this industry, and I think it's gonna be fun.
Yeah, win or lose, it should be a good time, I would think.
Yeah.
So let me kind of, by way of introduction, just say some things that I think I know about you.
All right.
So born in Alaska, worked in Alaska for a while as a commercial fisherman, been rich, been poor, been on drugs, been off drugs, now living in Costa Rica and married to a Costa Rican.
Yep, you got it. You got the whole thing.
Excellent. So, I don't know, should we start in Alaska?
Yeah, sure. I mean, there's not... I grew up mainly in a suburb outside of Seattle, but I was born in Kodiak, Alaska. It's a city that's about 5 square miles, and I think it has, 6,000 people or something like that. My mother and father are from there. My parents' parents are from there, and you know, it goes back a while. I think 3 or 4 generations going back to Alaska, and that's always.
So you're like descended from early settlers in Alaska.
Yeah, yeah, really. It's weird because, like, yeah, in the city I'm from used to be the capital of Russian America. Like, that used to be a country, I guess. And that was, Kodiak. And the city's name is Kodiak. It's a little island. It's just under the Aleutian Islands. And, yeah, it's my father was a fisherman. My grandfather was a fisherman. And it was different kind of coming from that bloodline because it's kind of, I don't know, there's like nobody I know really like that where ever, you know what I mean? And, you do have native ancestry and stuff like that. And it's a little different because it's one of those things that Chris Rock has a joke, like you never see an Indian family walking into a Denny's, you know what I mean? Like, or whatever you're descended from, you know, so it's all, but I mean, I didn't really grow up there or anything. When I did go work up in Alaska, it was pretty obvious. I was definitely the spoiled child that had, you know, interrupted the family line. But yeah, it's a different place. And it's, I think just kind of the work ethic my parents had coming from there, because you do have to, I think, work a little harder to make it there than maybe some other more affluent parts of the country. Not that, you know, those people are less hardworking. It's just, you know, I mean, it's the only state in the United States where the government pays you to live there. It's such a different place, you know? So I think that did help me growing up.
How'd you get started in poker?
When I was like 15, I was pretty broke, and there was I was really into metal. I was really into heavy metal, and my friends who were in a band, a little older than me, we were all hanging out at lunch, and there was a game like on the floor of like the lunchroom, because we such an overpopulated school, you know, we were all spilling onto the floors or whatever. And like, they all played on credit, and I didn't have a dollar to my name, but I was like, well, you know, shit, they're not going to get it from me if I lose, right? Or I'll figure out something, I thought. So I hopped in the game, and I didn't know if a flush beat a straight, and I won like $4 that day. And I mean, $4 was what I made after an hour of work after taxes when I worked at Arby's. So I was like, wow, this is pretty nice. So, and I got really into it, and I spent the first money I made on like Japanese comics and like metal CDs and stupid stuff like that. But eventually, you know, I started realizing, you know, there's nobody really holding me back in this facet. There was a lot of things, you know, it's just one, I didn't really have that much money growing up, and there was definitely, I was in a bit more of an affluent area, and you know, the people there weren't really bad people, but it's just one of those things, if you're not really used to it, you don't really know how to address it sometimes, and a lot of people think you're just kind of feigning it or something. So I definitely felt like it was held back in a lot of different places, or
just like, you know, like, hard to fit in socially with.
Yeah, exactly. And like, there were cases like I did like a school presentation one time, and it was one of those group projects, and I did most of the work, but like, I didn't bring a pair of slacks because I don't know, I just didn't have that, you know, I didn't have like nice clothes to wear for a presentation. I didn't even think of getting them or anything. It was just one of those, I don't know, my mind just didn't think about it. And I got graded down an entire letter grade, and I was, you know, hey, that, I don't really think that's fair. You know what I mean? I was like, this would have been a bit of a strain for me to get, like, financially. And I dressed decent, you know what I mean? And there were, you know, and the teachers thought I was putting them on, you know, like, oh, yeah, yeah. Like, you didn't have a pair of slacks back home. And it was, you know, not that, I'm sure I did. They were just too small or something. But, yeah, so when I started experiencing the pure meritocracy of poker, I really got addicted, and I read every book in my local library. I took notes. I read The Theory of Poker 3 times. I played in every game I could. My a friend of mine, you know, he got a car for his 15th birthday, and I was like, we're driving to every game. We grinded a site back then called homepokergames.com. And, you know, there were just all, this was 2005, 2004, the moneymaker era, and there were just guys like throwing money around. And we just tried to get to every one of these games, and, you know, we slept like 3 hours a night, showed up at school looking like shit, and, you know, and did that. And there was sometimes.
So you were like a road gambler at 15.
Yeah, no, I mean, if we made real money at it, maybe we could have claimed that. But no, I mean, we were taking our lumps, you know. It was fun, you know. We'd start on like Friday night and, you know, go till Sunday night sometimes. And just, it was fun. Yeah, it was a lot of fun. But yeah, I don't think, you know, it kind of gave me the chops before playing poker online. Like, I definitely felt more adjusted when I got into it online, but I definitely did not make a ton of money, like road gambling, as you put it.
Well, how did you get the bankroll to do that in the first place? I mean, I'm assuming you needed at least like a couple hundred dollars to play in those games.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I always, I had a job at Arby's, so I saved money from that. I always really liked working. I mean, I just like making a buck. I did landscaping when I was younger. I worked at a Persian carpet store. I schlepped carpets back and forth, with amazingly thrilling job, by the way. But you know, and I picked up odd jobs, and then at some point, you know, I just kept, I was making like 10-20 bucks every time I was at school, like every week. And then eventually it just, you know, it turned out I had like $200, and I remember getting from like $200 to $1,000 was like the hardest thing I'd ever done in my life, but I never could seem to lose that $200. And yeah, I mean, that's pretty much about how it went.
So it's not everybody who gets into poker and decides to work at it, decides to go to the library and read every book, decides to play a lot in a disciplined way, and, you know, who decides to work at it. Do you think it's was it some early experience, or do you think it's just this feature of your character that you've described, that you're just a working person who likes to work at things, that was what you did? Like, you didn't try to get luckier, you didn't try to, I don't know, whatever, read goat entrails or something to try to figure out like how to play poker. You decided to work at it. Why was that? I think that makes you unique compared to a lot of poker players.
Man, you got a deep voice. You reminded me of like Morgan Freeman, like the voice of God, man. It was a little different. But no, I don't know if it would be anything. One thing that helped me with my mother is my mother never let me, I didn't realize this till recently, but my mother never let me make an excuse about anything, like just anything. And it was kind of, you know, the kids in my, where I grew up, you know, they had some money, and, you know, their parents had, I guess, like the leeway to, you know, let them slide on a few things. And my mother never put up with that. Like, just never. It was, you know, if I got a bad grade, it's a, you should have talked to the teacher. You know, you should have found a way to get some extra work. I remember one time I lost like a really expensive book, and I thought, you know, okay, well, my parents will pay for this, right? It was like $60, and my mom went, you're gonna go to the school and work it off. I was like, are you serious? And she, yeah, you're gonna go work it off. And I was like, I don't even know if this school will know what that means, like, you know what I mean? But yeah, so I had to go out, and for, you know, there was a Saturday of mine, like on a break, I had to go clean up the whole school with the janitor, you know what I mean? And then they let me off the hook for that $60, and I really realized, you know, oh man, $60 is really worth something. You know what I mean? If you can get a hold of $60 in one night, like doing something you kind of love, you should really hold on to that. So maybe more out of, you know, maybe more out of love for the game, I tried to treat it seriously. I think it's also, you got to love the grind. They asked Bryan Cranston, I heard Bryan Cranston on Adam Carolla's podcast, and they were talking about his career, you know, leading up to Malcolm in the Middle. And I think he was like 35 when he got on that show, and he had really scattered success. He didn't really do that well. He, you know, he had bit parts here and there, but nothing serious. And they asked him, you know, how the hell did you keep so positive? I mean, he got turned down for three roles the week he got the Malcolm in the Middle gig. And he said, well, you know, he almost didn't even understand the question. He was like, well, I love to act. I love the process of acting. I love memorizing the lines. I love showing up. I loved giving it my all, and in a way, I think he loved failing because he learned from it each time. And not like I was anywhere near that level of maturity when I was a kid, but I just loved that there was something that nobody could hold me back in. And even though, you know, there were times I was younger and I was like, oh, the luck, man, this is bullshit, I'm running bad, da-da-da-da-da. There was always a sense that I can get to another game. I can work a little harder. I can find a new edge. And I think I got really addicted to that, not so much the money.
And you came on and you said that you're always hawking 30 different things. So that kind of grind and hustle is still something you have, you think?
Yeah, and I mean, there's a lot of money analyzing poker right now. I think, I've hung out with a lot of great players, and I kind of understand. I feel like I'm a really good poker player, but I don't feel like I'm that top tier, like ethereal, I don't know, like, you know, see into your soul type player. And I don't think I ever will be, but I really enjoy the analysis of poker and really breaking things down and trying to take it. Einstein said, if you can't explain something to your mother, you don't really understand it. And I really love bringing poker to that level and seeing if I can break it down for myself, break down different things. And yeah, I mean, it's in the people who've supported me have been way more supportive than I ever would have expected. And so, yeah, and I there's a lot of money in being an analyst, so I guess I focused on that a little more. And it's been good, and it's been, you know, it helps you as a poker player as well. And yeah, it's weird, like, thinking like you have hustle or something, but I just don't like waking up and like not doing shit with my day, you know. I don't like, right, you know, I'll get to the tournaments at 11. It's like, I know I'm capable of waking up at 8. And it's like, if I do a lesson, you know, if I'm watching hand histories for an hour, that's like good preparation for playing a session. I used to do that for free, you know what I mean? So if I can make money at it, I'd kind of be a fool not to do it.
Well, I mean, obviously poker is meritocratic in a lot of the ways that you described, but I do think there are some advantages that that the rich kids get, or that they got, especially in like 2004 or 2005. And what, right, I have in mind specifically is, I mean, I don't know if I was quite in the same circumstances that you were, but I mean, it definitely would have been a big deal to me to lose even a couple $100 playing poker,
oh, for sure,
when I was starting off. And I mean, as a result, like, I started playing probably around the same time you did, and I was playing online in like 2004, 2005. And I mean, now in retrospect, you hear people talk about like how great the 5-10 game was on party, right, poker in that era. And like, it was just the furthest thing from like the idea of putting up $1,000 to play poker. It was just like unthinkable to me, even if I could have scraped it together. And I think, you know, for people who might have had the same level of talent and work ethic that we did, but people for whom losing a couple $1,000s was not going to be the end of the world, I mean, that gives them a bit of a foot up in terms of their ability to like jump into bigger games, make more money, get a bigger bankroll, etc.
I feel you, but like, I've been reading this book called When Running Was Young and So Were We, and like, caveat emptor, it's my co-writer on pokerheadrush.com, my blog, but it's the guy I write the blog with. And he was, he had an interview with, Phil Knight, I think is the guy who founded Nike. And they were talking to him, and he was talking about how much he failed as an athlete. And the only crazy thing he ever did at Nike, the only thing he ever did was start Nike. And they were asking him about, you know, who stuck it out, who kept that company together. And he was saying, you know, a lot of the winners, a lot of the guys from good families, you know, the nice haircuts, the tailored suits and all that, the second the shit hit the fan, they were out. Like, that was in, by the way, am I allowed to swear on your show? I mean, I guess,
yes,
that ship's already sailed, but okay, sorry.
Yes. We have the explicit tag. Just
oh, it cool, is. Cool. All right. I won't play it up, but yeah, this is how I, you know, father's a fisherman, mother worked with inner city youth. This is how I actually talk. But they, you know, and he said, you know, a lot of these guys who grew up winning and things were doing pretty easy for them, when things got tough, they were out. He said it was the losers, you know, more or less, he didn't have really a better word, but the guys who lost a lot in life, who stuck it out at Nike and were the guys who got those share options and kept going. And yeah, of course, there were times like, yeah, I wanted to play 5-10 on party. I wanted to play it in Paradise, you know what I mean? I wanted to play that 100 rebuy, whatever the hell they called it on Paradise back in the day, because I started back then. I didn't have the money for it. But a lot of those guys, you know, they haven't really stuck it out. You know what I mean? If it comes quickly, you don't really appreciate it. You know what I mean? I really appreciate everything I have, and I think I probably have like 1/10th, 1/20th what a lot of these kids had or have at some point. Because yeah, you know, you take a shot, it goes well, then you take another shot, it doesn't go well, and it's like, oh, this is all bullshit, you know what I mean? But if you really work up to it, and you know, you take a shot and it doesn't work, but it's a small percentage of your role, you can kind of look back at everything you've built and gone, you know what I mean? I still built this. I still put this together from my own beats, from my own plays, from the really small stakes. And I can be proud of this. If you kind of just took shots because, you know, mom and dad gave you a grand here, a grand there, and, you know, it all falls apart, you all kind of felt like it was a free roll thing at the beginning anyway. So I understand what you're saying, but to cultivate discipline, I don't think it's bad starting from the bottom. And a lot of the guys I know who had a lot more money than me really didn't appreciate it. And now, sadly, sometimes it's gone. And they really didn't cultivate a love for learning. That's for sure.
I'm glad you mentioned reading, because it reminded me that I wanted to thank you. You recommended a novel on your blog called A Constellation of Vital Phenomena.
Oh, cool, man.
Yeah, I'd say that's one of the best books that I've read, probably ever, but certainly in the last couple of years. And I came across it somewhere else as well, but usually I have to have a book recommended at least two places before I'll pick it up, and you were one of them. So thank you for that.
Oh, you're welcome, man. I'm just tickled pink anybody would read a book that I recommend. That's awesome, man. Thank you.
Okay, so when do you get to the point where you're, by the time you graduate high school, are you playing poker professionally?
When I graduated high school, I left high school in the middle of the year. My family, my whole family loved drugs. And ironically, when you spend a lot of money on drugs, you don't have a lot of money for other things. So things were not going that well at the homestead. And, you know, it got really bad that year, like really bad. And, you know, people in and out of whatever, you know, out of respect for my family, who's doing pretty well, I probably shouldn't go too far into it. But I left my house in the middle of senior year. I moved to a street a few streets over. Here comes the big woe unto me story. But I moved to a place called Casino Road on Everett. SWAT hit our block 3 times in a month. Which was, to me, it was pretty cool the first time. I'd never seen SWAT, but, you know, the third time you're like, maybe I'm not on the right block here. yeah, I mean, I was living in a garage without heating or plumbing. So, yeah, I mean, all my money was kind of going into like paying my bills and stuff. And it got to a point I wasn't really cutting it with poker. So, you know, I asked my dad for money, and my dad told me, you know, he's got that work ethic. Like if you're a guy and you're an adult, you got to work for it. You know what I mean? Which of course I hated him for at the time, because if you've ever watched Deadliest Catch, he's one of those guys. He's one of those captains, right? And he said, you know, if you want to make money, you got to work for it. So you're going to come up to Alaska. I'll get you a reference, but I'm not going to send you anything. I'm not going to send you money. I was grateful for the reference, so I went up and I worked as a commercial fisherman. I was the worst commercial fisherman ever, but, you know, I stuck it out. And I got some money from that, but when I came back from high school, I mean, after I graduated high school, you know, I still didn't have, like, 6 months of expenses. And I didn't want to go pro and then, like, get a job again, because there was a lot of people who, you know, I was kind of like the drugged-out loser, like, growing up, and I didn't really want to give those people like the satisfaction of seeing me fail. So I was like, I'm going to work a job and I'm going to save up money. And when I do go pro, there's going to be 6 months of savings on the side. And that way, if I ever do go completely broke, I've got 6 months to figure my shit out. I don't know what that's going to be, but I'll have that, right? And that was about the benchmark for what would make me feel secure. So I got a job as a security guard at Safeco Insurance, and that was an interesting job. A lot of people want to bomb an insurance headquarters, is what I found out. yeah, a little bit rattling, you know what I mean? But yeah, it was a good job. I could fall asleep on the job. Probably shouldn't have you know, probably shouldn't have, but I was 18. I didn't really think about it.
It's pretty standard for a security guard, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you got to be careful, though. You got to pick your spots, you know what I mean? You got to – well, the parking garage has a lot of traffic at this time, so I can fall asleep in the booth after that. And, you know, there's this security camera here, but that guy's on shift right now. He's not going to be checking it. But, yeah, it was you know, I go work there for 8 hours. I go back home, and I play poker for 6 to 10 hours, and – yeah, I'd repeat that every day for a couple months. And then I had in the month of October after I turned 18, I had a month where I made $7,000 playing tournaments. And I made like $1,200 from my real job. So I figured, okay, this is a no-brainer. And I put all the money in savings and I went pro. And I did nothing but lose money for the next couple months. So it was, yeah. And then, you know, the girl I was living with and me, we had a lot of problems and shit. But then I, you know, I moved to a new place and I like swallowed my pride and moved down to like $16 Sit-and-Goes, which nobody thought you could make a living at back then. I started like 24 tabling them, and it was like pretty much me, Raincon, and Space Gravy were the only ones doing that. And then, yeah, I started slowly building up, and then, yeah, it started going well.
You were playing tournaments kind of exclusively from the start?
Yeah, I don't know why. Probably one of the dumbest decisions I've ever made now that I think about it. But no, I just like tournaments. I don't know why. It wasn't like socially intelligent either, because there was a lot of times I was living in a college town. So a lot of like my friends from high school were still there. And there was a lot of times, you know, like a girl would call me up, oh, you know, let's go hang out. And it's, you know, I just registered for a bunch of sit-and-goes and stuff, but I couldn't beat cash. I was just terrible at cash. I didn't get into cash really until I was like 19, and tournaments started becoming like actually difficult. So I started playing on Cake Poker right when they came out, and it was actually like 1-2 and 2-4 was obscenely soft back then.
Yeah, that's one of my regrets. I didn't get on Cake Poker.
So. Oh.
Okay, so what's the arc of your career from there?
Let's see. Well, I moved into the crap hole. I got turned down for an apartment underneath a freeway, because back then I could pay off the entire lease. But, you know, back then being a commercial fisherman or a poker player was, I don't know, both were not really respected. So, like, I turned in my lease thing, and I didn't really have anyone to co-sign or anything. So, yeah, eventually I got a really shithole apartment. And, like, my bedroom was probably about the size of, I don't know what would be a good reference, like my coffee table now, like, and it's my coffee table plus like a couch. And, I played poker like all day and every day, and it started getting a little better, a little better, a little better. I moved back into MTTs, 'cause there was a while I wasn't really doing well at MTTs. And, I don't know, something just started clicking, and I started making a lot of final tables, getting deep in a lot of things. And I won a entry to APPT Manila, the first ever APPT. You know, I spent a lot of money and time out there partying, really enjoyed it. And I was like, hey, I want to play more live tournaments, right? So I started writing the articles for Pocket Fives just to kind of, you know, get myself more established professionally. And I kept, I got a backer, and the first time I played the 200 rebuy, it was the first time I played the 200 rebuy, and it was a pretty big tournament back then. I chopped it with one of my good friends in poker, and it was for $50,000. So that was really the start. And then, you know, I was like, oh man, I'm a genius now, right? So I moved to high stakes tournaments, and I just get my ass handed to me over a few months. But then by that point, you know, I had a very inflated ego and reputation, and I could kind of talk the talk, maybe not walk the walk. And a lot of people had money back then, so there's a lot of people who wanted to back me. Just, well, if you can write eloquently, you must be a good poker player, which really wasn't true. But fortunately, I did seem to learn eventually, and kept moving up. And, you know, and then I did some things I thought was a little smarter at the time. I moved to South Korea to play games there. I moved to Europe after that. I moved to Malta. like right before poker came there, because my, you know, I could move my German horses there and stuff like that. And there was a lot of games going on. And yeah, a lot of it's just game selection and, you know, finding the games where people are throwing money away. I mean, I would make good money at cash games, but I played like 9-7 back then or something like that. So it was a good time to be in poker, and I at least had some kind of wherewithal to take advantage of it.
Did you have any qualms about getting backing just because you seem, I mean, not that it's actually, you know, contrary to self-sufficiency, but it seems like it's been a big thing for you to kind of make it on your own. Did backing feel like a compromise there?
Yeah, it felt weird, but I mean, I let my eyes get too big for my stomach or whatever you say. Like, I wanted to play the big tournaments. What really kind of, I went to APPT Seoul and they sat Joe Hashem at my table. I like just turned 19, right? And you'll never hear me say like I kicked a guy's ass normally, but like Joe Hashem was just like a sitting duck that day. He was jet lagged or something, right? I look back now and I realize I held over him, and he probably didn't want to be at that tournament. But for a 19-year-old kid, like kicking a world champion's ass one day, you start thinking like maybe I'm really good at this game, you know what I mean? And the only way I could play 10Ks, yeah, I mean, I wanted to be self-sufficient, but I was like, okay, if I want to have 100 buy-ins for 10Ks, which isn't even close to my normal bankroll standards.
And also, it's not really enough anyway.
Yeah, exactly, right? Yeah, and I was like, I normally had 300 buy-ins for tournaments, and I thought that was cutting it. And I was like, it is going to take me forever to get to that $1 million. So, yeah, I took backing, but I always felt weird about it. And the first time I owed somebody $100,000, I was like, Jesus Christ. You know, like, you know, my mother used to make like 35K a year, and now I owe a little less than three times that. What just happened?
Did you end up getting out of the hole with the did he drop you?
I have never been dropped in makeup. I have always paid back everything I've owed. Somehow, there were definitely times I didn't have the talent, but somehow something came together.
Impressive. So when do you start using yourself? Drugs?
When do I start using drugs? That the question?
Yeah.
Oh, fuck. A very long time. No, I mean, like, growing up, drugs were, it was just what everybody did around me. The same way like a lot of people smoke a cigarette when they get off of work, like my community of people would smoke a joint and drink it quite a bit. So when I was younger, I was really anti-drug. I just like being clear-minded or whatever, even though during some of those late night Arby's shifts, I probably should have smoked a spliff to get through it. But I don't know. I really liked caffeine, and then the school started saying, you know, I was acting up. I was always talking to shit through every one of my classes, clowning on everybody, getting sent out of the class, and hustling a game in the back of the class. And they were like, you know, you need to get your kid together. And I was on the system. My family was on the system, and we found out, oh, you can get Adderall for free through the system. We think this kid has ADD. Does he have ADD? Yeah, sure, he's got ADD. You know, whatever. Some guy says you can't focus. Like, literally the doctor's appointment was like, you can't focus, right? Yeah, okay, cool. And they gave me Adderall, and that was like awful, because I was just like, oh my god, this is my shit. Like, this is good. And, you know, I started popping in every one of my drinks, and you know, I was like a fat kid, and like overnight I'm losing weight. I shut up all the time. I used to like talk and clown a lot, but that was more out of anxiety or something, right? And overnight, I'm just quiet, and people are giving me more credit, and I'm not annoying as hell. So people, yeah, I make a few more friends, right? And so I'm getting skinnier. I'm getting, I start being able to sleep like 3-4 hours a night. So I'm playing poker more than anybody I know. I'm making more money than like all the kids in my school who are, you know, in these big houses and stuff, but they, you know, their parents are pretty smart fiscally. They don't just hand them hundreds of dollars, thousands or whatever. And I just got really into it. And I think that initial like getting into getting altered really affected me. And yeah, when I went up to do commercial fishing, I was off the system because they found out I wasn't living with my mother anymore. And coming down was, and I mean, I'd use street amphetamines when I couldn't get enough of the state's prescribed Adderall. You can still hear the drug addiction sometimes. You're going to hear me forget words and say wrong words, but yeah. And yeah, when I came home, you know, I started drinking for the first time. There was a girl I really liked. I never liked drinking. And, you know, she's like, oh, have a drink with me. I was like, all right, you know, if you'll hang out with me. Blah, blah, blah. And then I drank and I, wow, this shit's amazing. And then I was 19. I smoked weed the first time. I was like, wow, this is incredible. Or 18, I started doing my first painkillers. And and the thing that was really bad is a lot of people get altered and they can't do shit all day. Like, I was so wired up anyway. If I used a substance, I just kind of turned into a semi-normal person. And not normal, but like, you know, just a little more calculated, a little more relaxed, especially when I smoked weed. I smoked weed all day, every day for probably 5 years. And, you know, up until the end, I seemed like a pretty normal person. Like, people couldn't believe I was high all the time. It was just so a part of me, you know what I mean? I look back now and I realize I was using it as ADD medication, or I don't believe in ADD. I think it's bullshit, but I don't want to believe I have Asperger's, but I take the medication for Asperger's, and then I sound like a normal human being. I kind of sound like a ranting lunatic when I don't take those meds. So yeah, I realized I was kind of treating that, and yeah, it was at the end, it was not fun.
Well, and I mean, a lot of people use, even today in the poker community, is like Adderall as a performance enhancing drug, essentially, right?
Yeah, no, it's really popular, but you know, a lot of them, I'm not going to name names, but they burn out and it's not pretty. It's I don't know. It's weird because, like, I don't think drugs should be illegal, because, like, if you make it illegal, you just put the power in the criminal system. You know what I mean? It's like, all right, you guys make all the money from this substance, because if there's a demand for it, it's always going to be had. But man, it's like one of the things we work on the most with my consulting is, like, we have so many kids who had an amazing careers and they just started smoking weed every day, or anytime the session got a little stressful, they popped an Adderall, and then magically every session is stressful for some reason. And I mean, how much work it takes to bring them back. I just, Jesus, like, if I could do it again, I would never let my friends do it or anything.
What made you give it up?
Well, I met my wife, and when I was around her, I just didn't want to be fucked up, because I was like, wow, you know, this girl is beautiful and this girl's smart. This girl can hold a conversation on, like, pretty much anything. She's well-read. I just don't want to be fucked up around her, because I think she's smart enough. She's going to go, oh, you know, forget this kid. So I just started, you know, when I went and saw her, I just wouldn't smoke weed and I wouldn't drink, and I was super self-conscious. And, you know, she started realizing, oh, this kid smokes weed a lot and he drinks a lot. And then I took her on the tour one time. I was doing a couple of EPTs, and I just didn't smoke weed while I was out there or drink. And, you know, she liked me better as that kind of person. And I was, you know, I was much more stressed. I much more anxious, but I was myself, and she was super accepting. I was okay, you know, maybe I can pull this off. And then I got back home and, you know, everything went to shit. But yeah, there was a point, to give you the really dramatic answer, I went from living in a mansion with a private beach, with a live-in maid, a personal assistant, 3-4 horses playing for me, you know, like physical therapist visiting the house, and like just every service attending the house, so I could spend more time playing MTTs. And I went from that to, you know, I just, one day I had I had no money in the bank account. I was dependent. Some people owed me money, they didn't pay me back. And, you know, I'm not going to put them on blast, but yeah, there was, you know, I was like, okay, you know, that was his business. I was like, well, I get money from here on this day. I get money from here on this day. And then I had another record loss. I was like, Jesus, right? And a lot of people owed me money, just didn't pay me back because they were like, oh, you know, this kid's gone. You know, the money's not going anywhere. And I don't know. I don't think he's going to be able to do anything about it. He's not going to be in this industry much longer. And I mean, they had a point. Like, I lost hundreds of thousands of dollars backing just because I was high all the time and like just not watching over my investments. And, you know, certain people see a drugged out person there, you know, you know, I'm going to coast too. You know, it's a, and yeah, it kind of, it woke me up. I knew I'd fucked up. So when I went broke, you know, when I went broke, like my wife's family like had to buy me a mattress to throw into like a shithole apartment in downtown Costa Rica. I was like, dude, what the fuck did I just do with my life? And I was like, you know, all right, keep this motivated. And I went cold turkey and I started running like 15 miles a day. That became my new addiction. And I started coaching because I really like the 1 hour, one unit of pay. 1 hour, one unit of pay. That was all my mind could really hold on to at that point. I was so anxious. Just being able to talk with my students helped me so much to get out of that rut. And then as I was talking through the lessons and everything, I started realizing, man, I don't really, you know, because my students ask so many questions, and God bless beginners, they have such amazingly innocent questions sometimes. And I was like, I don't think I really know how to play this game. So I got really into the math, and I was super, you know, I was withdrawing horrible. But like, I just focused on the math and everything and grinding and doing lessons. And eventually, I mean, but real talk, it took, I mean, there's a depression after you stop using substances for 6 years or whatever it is. And if you do a harder drug, you just do something for a year, you're going to have this depression because your mind is so used to having that rush. And I mean, it probably took me like every year I felt better for the last like 3 years, 4 years. And but it's been you know, that first year was like hell on earth, man. And like, it was just so hard to feel good about anything again. And second and third weren't much better, but eventually it was a trip.
And your wife stuck with you through that?
Yeah, she's
pretty lucky.
She's a boss. I mean, she's crazy smart. She's, yeah, obviously super blessed for that one. Yeah, I have no idea what I did to deserve that, but she's been, I don't even know how to word how amazing a woman she is. Like, she never gave up on me ever. And my family, to my credit, always has had this attitude, like, if there's anyone who can do it, it's you. So I never really had the, you know, like, hating on you because you're a drug addict from the family or any of that, or from my now wife. So yeah, that was incredible.
How did you end up in Costa Rica in the first place? Was that a Black Friday thing?
No, that was, it was a couple years before, like maybe a year. I wanted to house my horses so I could like watch over them. And I was, okay, let's look at doing this in LA or something. It was like, oh my God, like this is going to be expensive. Right. And you know, we started looking around at properties in Costa Rica, me and my business partner at the time. And it's, wait, hold on. It's that much for a beachside mansion? All right. You know, and we moved them all in there, flew them all out, and it was a blast. We got to pretend we were entourage for a while, but then, you know, like little things start accruing. You know, it's like, oh, the internet goes out in this part of the country a lot, so you got to get satellite internet, or, you know, you got to buy food from this one specific grocery store, and it's more expensive there. And there's, you know, there's just all these little things that added up. So it didn't end up being as cheap as I thought it was. It was still pretty obscenely cheap, but yeah, it was pretty much a way to house my horses.
So you just told them, like, if you want to be backed by me, you have to move to Costa Rica and live in a house with me?
I had one kid still living in Malta, but yeah, for most of them, I said, yeah, I'm going to, you know, if I'm going to coach you, I want to be, you know, and I want to see how they, you know, walk into the grind room in the morning. If they're hanging their head or something, I want to say something and I want to find out what's up. If they're, you know, it's really hard to keep track of somebody when they're on the other side of the planet. You know what I mean? It's really easy for someone to sound real chipper for 20 minutes on the phone. It's not really that easy for someone to hold themselves together all day when they're really not doing that well with the downswing. And if they do manage to hold themselves together all day, they're probably going to start artificially feeling better anyway. So I thought it was going to be the smarter decision.
So in that respect, you were more like hiring for a standard job. It's just the job was in Costa Rica, and if you wanted you had to go there.
Exactly. And I mean, they wanted to come out. You know, we had a lot of fun. We partied a lot. It was a good time.
I mean, it's obviously not a new thing now for a lot of American poker players to have relocated to other countries. And the impression I get from most of them is that they haven't really integrated themselves into the culture of the country. They're just sort of in their own little bubble. And that doesn't seem like the approach that you, I mean, obviously you're married to a Costa Rican woman. Was that like a conscious decision on your part that you wanted to actually like be part of Costa Rica?
Yeah. I mean, I think it was, I mean, it probably came out of, I mean, a melodramatic answer, but it probably came out of self-loathing. Like I didn't really fit in the States. Like I was just, I don't know. I just didn't fit in. And then like my first country I moved to was South Korea when I was 19, and it was, I realized when I was speaking a different language I felt like a different person, you know what I mean? And like, not like I weren't learned to speak Korean worth a shit, but
that's just my next question.
no. And I tried to speak with a vendor the other day, and it was just, oh my god, like so bad. When I was in the midst of like different customs and speaking a different language, I felt like a different person, like I could change. So I really grew attracted to that. And then, you know, I tried, but then, when I moved to Malta, everybody hated me so much as an American in Europe. I just finally, you know, I did kind of stay in my bubble and dress like an American and talk like an American. And I didn't want to learn a damn word of Italian, and I was proud of it. But when I came to Costa Rica, the people are so nice and they're so helpful when you try to speak the language here, they're really helpful. They really break it down and try to say it to you again and stuff. And that wasn't really my experience. Like in Korea, people would probably just yell at me. And in Italy, they would probably yell quite loud and then tell me to leave the bar. But when I speak Spanish, the other thing is their dialect here is super clear. It's like when I listen to someone from Spain, it's like, oh my God, what did he say? Are from Cuba or the Dominican Republic. But when I listen to my in-laws speak Spanish, I understand, I don't know, like 70% of it. And obviously, if you get that much, you can fill in the blanks most of the time. So, I mean, they kind of help me along with it too. And then it's just so much more fun when you know the language. You get to make real friends from the country and stuff. I mean, Americans are great and all, but a lot of the Americans who run from America are not that great.
Paying close attention to the World Cup.
It's pretty fun out here, man. It was pretty. You see that Poker Stars Pro got thrown out for celebrating a goal in Spain's face?
Yeah, but I figured that there must have been more to that story, and probably if you're getting dropped as a Poker Stars Pro, you did something pretty severe. But then I didn't care enough to follow up. So.
Yeah, it was. I just saw the headline or something. I figured like, he wasn't drawing anybody to the site anyway. And they were like, oh, cool, somewhat of an excuse. And we'll move with this. I mean, not that PokerStars overreacted, but maybe, you know, probably there's a little more to the story. And probably he wasn't bringing in huge numbers anyway. But yeah, World Cup's been awesome here, man. It's like they go nuts for it. Like whenever there's a goal, you can hear like 1,000 car horns going across. And like everybody's running out in the streets and everything. And it's a, like watching that game was incredible.
So for those people listening to the show a week later, we're recording this after when Costa Rica is 1-0.
Let's try not to look to the future. It's too painful to imagine.
Yeah.
What about looking to the future for yourself? Are you planning on staying in Costa Rica indefinitely?
Oh yeah, I'm probably gonna live here the rest of my life, or keep a house here or something. I love the people too much. It's weird because like in Seattle, it's like really popular to be an asshole to everybody. Like you say hi to someone, they're like and they run into their apartment with their groceries. It's like, all right, you know. But if you say hi to someone here, everybody wants to talk, and they're all you know, I was like, I was paving my driveway, and my neighbor saw me, and, you know, he just wanted to get to know me, so he helped me pave my driveway for a little bit. And yeah, I was like, wow, all right. You know, and then, and I, now when I was younger and like I helped, somebody helped me with a house chore, I assumed I just sold myself into their servitude at some point. So I thought, you know, in the future, they're going to call me in for a favor, but they really just don't expect anything. They just, you know, they just want to talk for a bit, say what's up. And yeah, look, I mean, this is the most, it's you're an hour away from the beach, and that'll be really hot, tropical. The rainforest is right next to it. You're an hour away from the mountains, really fresh, a lot colder. And San Jose as a city is real film noir crazy. So I just I like it out here. It's different.
And poker is going well for you again.
Yeah. Thank God. I guess you want me to elaborate on that, huh?
I was ready to elaborate for you, but yeah, I'd more.
No. You do it. I'll feel better. No.
I was gonna say, I mean, you're. If I understand correctly, one of the big breaks for you was winning the. It was a 1K W Coupe second chance, right?
Yeah, that was I chopped it, but yeah.
I think I was final two tables of that.
For real. Oh, cool, man.
I was in Montreal, and my internet went out, and I had to, like, scramble to find a 24-hour internet cafe. Three tables left. And
God!
Yeah, it was a pretty unpleasant experience.
And it's impossible to come back in with a good attitude, right?
Yeah, I kind of got money in bad a few times, making stupid plays, sucked out, and then, you know, so I was actually, like, back in good shape again, but just continued to, like you said, I just wasn't in a good mindset. Thankfully, it happened because I made day two of the main event also, and thankfully the internet kicked out after day one had already ended, so at least I didn't get disconnected during a 5K, but yeah, it was pretty nasty.
That's a good point. Yeah, that was the thing I didn't like about that, if I could complain about a tournament where I made 120,000 in, it was that it finished like 4 hours before the main event started again. I was like, oh, this is awesome. You know, and of course you're all amped up, so I slept like 3 hours and lost with queens to Jack 10 on the bubble, but I couldn't have given a shit less. I was like, okay, I'm going to bed. But yeah, the 1K went pretty well. And then a lot of the fun thing with analyzing poker lately is I feel like I make, it's really hard to become a really, really great player, but you can find little points of profitability in a lot of different spots I didn't see before. So if you ever, you guys know who Brad Gilbert is, the tennis player?
I don't.
He was the trainer to Andre Agassi. And if you could ever watch this guy, John McEnroe called him the worst fucking tennis player who ever played on ever. But he was ranked fourth in the world because he just knew how to throw garbage and find just little points of exploitation at any point. And you watch a game of his, it's almost laughable. It's like they let a high school kid on the court and he's just doing every goofy move nobody else would try, and it just happens to work when put in the right sequence. I feel a little more like that when I play poker now, that there's all these things that quote unquote bad players do that if you do at the right time actually yield a profit. And if you combine them, you get a lot of cashes that you probably wouldn't have gotten before. So my last WSOP was profitable, my last PCA was profitable, my last scoop was profitable. And it was finding a lot of spots I think even a lot of players today would have balked at, but certainly like 4 years ago, people would have been like, what in the hell are you thinking? And I still get a lot of people, you know, you're terrible, I can't believe how you play, da da da. You do so many things that are legitimately horrible, blah, blah, blah. But it's been really fun from that forefront. Not that I'm making like huge profits, but you know, just like cashing and the main and the PCA main and winning like that, winning one of those $215 tournaments out in Vegas and stuff like that. And final tabling this scoop 500R. It was a lot of, I mean, obviously the deck helped me at certain times, but there's a lot of points even people with really complete games, like if they're not really looking out for it, they're giving up chips in some select spots, and it's been really fun to locate them.
And I'm wondering how you identify those spots.
A lot of it's statistics, because I don't really feel like I have a great feel in regard. Like, I don't feel like I have a great table feel. Like, I know I definitely have experience and it helps me, but it's not, I used to room with Fraz Jaka and go to different tournaments with him, and I'd see him like call down with nine high and I'd be like, I could never do that. You know what I mean? But it's a lot of it is just simple math. And it's like, they kind of kicked me out of math class in high school, but it's like eighth grade math. It's like very simple algebra. If you read Let There Be Range with CTS, it kind of has a basic primer in it. And with tools like Flopzilla right now, you can really start. I imagine Phil Ivey's mind looks like Flopzilla. For us mere mortals, it's really good to have something that can kind of graph all the different hands you think in a guy's range. And there's a lot of times you'll be in a spot, if you only experience a spot like, let's say you experience it like 40 times a year, that's only a couple times in a month. Like, unless you have this incredible talent for categorization and a willingness to make a huge mistake, you're probably not going to find a play in that area. But if you look at his range and graph all the hands and you go, holy shit, most of these combinations are not better than second pair, I bet he's folding to a jam, you're going to find that point. And a lot of people are not going to find it. And the more you get into it, it's the more it's like seeing into the Matrix. It's incredible watching. Like, I know I'm never going to be in Tom Dwan's zip code, but when I watch him play, there's some plays I see him do now, and I'm like, oh, I know why he does that. it's such an amazing feeling. And getting to do it like deep in a 10K, and it's a big bluff, and you're not worried because, well, I mean, I would bet $1,000 nobody could prove this isn't an unprofitable play. That's when it's an immense feeling of gratification. It's really fun to play poker, even after doing it for 10 years.
But like, how do you even decide which flops or which situations you're going to put into Flopzilla to look at in the first place? You just kind of review hand histories and you're like, oh, that's a spot I never thought about before. Like, how do you decide where to look in the first place?
Yeah, you you start with a board. We all have boards we feel really bleh about. Like, I don't ever feel like I'm handling this board well, right? And you should go through your own hand histories. And anytime you feel uncomfortable, that's a really good feeling. A lot of people go, oh, you know, I felt uncomfortable in this spot. I must be a bad poker player. I better hide this from my friends and go, lol, standard, and move on from this. But no, you want to be uncomfortable and go, I need to learn more about this. This is something, like, when I met Jaka, he had, like, more money. Like, he had done so well. And I thought when he met me, you know, he'd be like, ah, yeah, whatever, you know, because I was definitely like the underachiever as far as like the MTT class that was touring the EPTs. I was the guy. I wasn't really sure why I was there, but I had one thing I was going to say and then it devolved into another thing, but he would always ask questions. Well, why do you think that? Why do you think that? And if he felt uncomfortable, he'd like come and go, okay, here was the situation. What do you think? He had no ego about him, you know? And so you take a spot you feel uncomfortable with and you open it up and you go, okay, what if he's opening 10% of the hands? What if he's opening 15% of the hands? What if he's opening 20% of the hands? What does that look like? What if he c-bets everything in his range? What if he checks back everything that missed? What if he only check? This is the most common one. What if he only checks when he has some showdown value? What does that do to his continuation betting range? Does that make it weaker or stronger? And then if I were to do this bet, you need to start learning some basic algebra. If I risk X to win Y, what percentage of the time does it need to work? And then you compare it to the number of the combinations you think are folding. And then you're going to start really having a basis for running some bluffs. And there's a lot of times you'll go through like every range you could give a guy. And you'll just find, like, unless this guy is Prefontaine or he's just, unless this guy is Phil Bort, there's probably no way he's balanced here. There's probably no chance. And so you have to start running that play whenever it's feasible, and it's not going to break the ATM. It's not going to alert everybody that you're a bluffing style player. And even though there are some times I don't really have a great reputation and everybody thinks I'm bluffing all the time, there are some times if they're going to have to shove all in with queen high to break even, there's a pretty damn good chance it's not going to happen. So you just have to keep applying that play. And then then it becomes fun. It's like, okay, does he realize I'm doing that? Because now I have to check raise call with second pair top kicker. And that's when the art of poker really comes in. It gets really fun.
That's a question that I encourage a lot of my students to think about, is like, okay, even if he does kind of realize what you're doing, what would he have to do to make it stop? And like you say, if the answer is shove with queen high or call you with ace high or check raise bluff the river, or just, you know, a number of other things that a lot of people are reluctant to do, then, you know, maybe you can do it anyway, even if it is kind of transparent, if the only way for them to combat it is to do something that's going to make them pretty uncomfortable and they might not even realize that that's what they have to do to combat it then.
Right. Another good follow-up question is, whatever they have to do, ask them how many times they've seen it. Right. Like, he's gonna have to turn his third pair, second pair, and a lot of his top pairs into a check raise bluff on the river, giving you 2.5 to 1. Okay, have you seen that? Well, maybe twice in my life. Well, it's probably a good idea to run this move, even if it is a little transparent and not quite balanced.
Well, we've kept you for about the hour that we promised you. Is there anything you feel like we didn't get to that you wanted to talk about?
No, man, this was a good time. Write me at, if you guys want to read my articles, I write a bunch of articles that come out in a myriad different places. If you want to get them all, just send to your email. And I do a lot of stuff for free. We do twitch.tv broadcasts where we just go over hand histories for free sometimes. I have another podcast I do. Is it okay if I say my podcast name on here?
Absolutely, all right. Absolutely.
What? OneOuter.com. You can check it out there. Sorry, what were you saying, Nate?
I said yes, do that.
Sorry. Okay. My connection is kind of messed up. But check out OneOuter.com. That's the podcast I do regularly. We just answer questions about MTTs on there. And if you write me at assassinautocoaching@gmail.com, I'll be sure to send you all the free stuff as soon as it comes out. And once in a while, I'm going to annoy you with an ad, but that's the price you got to pay. And yeah, I think that's about it.
And on Twitter, you're...
At The Assassinato on Twitter. And PokerHeadRush.com is my blog where I write lots of random stuff. Bluff... Oh, no, I'm not allowed to say that. Anyway, Bluff.com. If you go to past issues, you can read some of my articles. WPTMag.com, Pocket5s.com. Pocket Fives Training is where I do videos. I think that's about it.
I think you did leave something off that I wanted to mention. You recorded like the entire time you were playing Scoop.
I went delirious.
Unfortunately, I haven't watched a lot of it yet, but I did buy it, and it struck me as a pretty fantastic value for $50 to.
Thank you.
How many hours did it come to?
It came to 100 plus hours, I believe. Oh, but yeah, thank you for bringing that up. I feel like I've been bombarding everybody with that ad, so I guess I just forgot about it. But thank you for bringing it up. I really appreciate that. Yeah, I did a thing. I always record my own sessions anyway. Just I take little notes, like I'm betting because I think this and this is going to fold and stuff like that. And then I compare the game film to my hand history reviews, and I go, okay, where am I? You know, what concepts are not really coming into play when during game time, and what game time considerations am I not taking into consideration when I do hand history reviews? And you know, a friend of mine was house sitting for me, and he's a poker player, and he was just watching them on my hard drive. He's like, "You're an idiot for not selling these." So I recorded the entire scoop, the scoop 500R final table, another 15th place run, the entire live coverage, every hand announced the entire time. And it's $50 if you want to pick these up. A lot of people thought I could have charged more, but I have a lot of respect for you 25 NL grinders. And it sounds like a joke, but seriously, I know there's a lot of my kids come from like Eastern Europe or whatever, and I know they can't really afford that. And I really I wanted them to be able to buy it. And I thought it would just be kind of, there's the phone interrupting my spiel. But anyway, I thought it would just be like a fun thing. We'd sell a few copies, but you guys really came out in droves. And I really want to thank you for that. And I everybody has been happy with the product. So I think you'll be really happy with the product as well. Can you guys even hear me over that in the background?
Oh, yeah.
I don't even hear whatever it is in the background.
You don't even hear it? Oh, no. My answering machine has these screaming Latino people on it. But no, it's it's the entire thing, and every hand analyzed, and everybody who's ordered it enjoys it. All you have to do to get that is you send $50 to Assassinato, Costa Rica on PokerStars, alexfitzgerald88@gmail.com on PayPal, fitzgerald_alex@yahoo.com on MoneyBookers, and we'll just leave it at that for now. And if you think you don't understand my rambling right now, just write me at assassinatocoaching@gmail.com and we'll hook you up with the transfer details. And if you want to get at me for private coaching, private consulting, write me at assassinatocoaching@gmail.com.
Awesome. Well, thank you again, sir. It's been a very interesting conversation.
Thanks, guys. It was a good time. Take care.
Take care. Have a good night.
Devotion of a car, the light of the fair passage of a bill.